I is the only pronoun that can provide responsible, personal agency. Up to this point, this essay has taken the form of a traditional, objective, analytical description of the phenomenon of the blob by an intellectual commentator whose identity is not supposed to be particularly relevant, but whose intentions in communicating can, of course, be inferred. But since this essay is entitled The Blob and I, it must now become a personal narrative. It is time to follow the examples of many before me, like Augustine, Rousseau, and Newman, and attempt to describe the personality, history, and intentions of the I, whose experience and intentions provide the final part of this essay. Who am I, and why me? Who I am, my intentions, and my extraordinary narrative is, in my opinion, of paramount importance in providing a way to destroy the cohesion of that completely different phenomenon, the irresponsible, buck-passing blob. Since the pronoun that provides active, ultimate responsible agency is I, this manifestation of I am, or ego, can only flow from the intention generated by the purified, irreducible, personal soul, the intentional me. We are usually only aware of our souls when they're under attack. Before making the claim that my personal identity is socially and culturally constructed well enough to avoid absorption into the blob, I wish to make a few points about the context within which we are psychologically, socially, and historically located. In the metaphysical system that grew out of the Iron Age market economy, the outer world mankind had previously experienced magically was increasingly transformed into that of made things that we observe. This is the subject of Whitehead's fallacy of misplaced concreteness. And Marx's concern with the fetishism of commodities. At the same time, instead, believing we are souls, we ourselves progressively become nothing but minds in bodies in space. As things, there's little observable difference between a recently dead person and a sleeping one, whose inner self is, of course, experiencing itself wildly. The biological self, with its boundary of skin, is, however, far less real than the psychological or mental self, whose boundaries are far less fixed and objectified, being made up of the social roles we are enmeshed in from birth and which grow with us. Since humans are organisms like other animals, but with more complex nervous systems, we obviously share with them many behavioural challenges of living in the world. Fortunately, in the academic world, zoology, the study of living creatures as things, has been replaced by ethology, the study of animal behaviour in the wild, just as depth psychology has replaced Freudian rejection of the concepts of both superconscious and subconscious, or the mechanistic study of rats in mazes in the attempt to understand the human mind. As an implicate part of the cosmos, the involving, evolving animal self inherits thousands of years of experience that can be activated by suitable stimuli coming from our environment. This also applies to our experience as social beings living in cultural scenarios. Nietzsche described us as the mad animal living in fake history. And Jonathan Haidt's experiments in revealing the social pressures acting on students' interpretation of the meaning of events and their emotional responses confirms this. Haidt's conclusion is we are nothing like Plato's charioteer balancing the pull of two horses of reason and emotion. Instead, Haidt claimed we are like riders clinging onto huge elephants influenced by others in the herd, and our efforts to control their behaviour is very limited, as conservatives realise. I should add to this analogy the fact that elephants are very intelligent herd animals and usually socially almost entirely matriarchal. The males, however, are great ego trippers, and their restless behaviour attracts the females when they're on heat. I also assume that in Haidt's analogy, when they reach the edge of a cliff, the herd might slow down and change direction. In human terms, I mean by this that they could undergo a change of paradigm or cultural scenario when faced with the cliff of the collapse of the biosphere. This happened in the Axial Age transformation of consciousness after the collapse of the Bronze Age and Long Dark Age, which was made possible by the sudden socioeconomic changes associated with the easily available iron ore. The bourgeois individual as an egalitarian commodity trader, with the belief that he or she has a mind of their own, was the ultimate creation of this cultural paradigm shift. The transformation of our current cultural scenario is taking place as a consequence of two factors. Unprecedented electric power and communication is being to transform the cogs in the economic progress machine into electronic circuits. At the same time, the oil is running dry. The cog can no longer mesh together smoothly, and friction is bringing the mechanism to a grinding halt. The utilitarian cogs are crying out for meaningful roles denied to them in the highly cruel, ugly, cruel, and soulless economic progress machine. They're looking at each other in the social media to escape, but this narcissistic conformity to a folly is hollow and only makes things worse. The only solution is a completely new cultural paradigm. The machine metaphor needs replacing with a new one based on electricity, electromagnetic fields, neural networks, and instantaneous current flow are all better analogies than things in space that impact causally on each other, one after another, on a unidimensional timeline. We must rejoin the other animals and becoming organically re-embodied, in other words, accepting a cosmology based on process. Only idiots have minds of their own. It is worth pointing out that the Greek word for a man with a mind of his own is idiot. As Shakespeare frequently reminds us, the social self is an inner space world, peopled by many characters who act out their parts when the scenario or narrative calls for them to do so. Age and gender are, of course, taken into account, but there are many factors that make up this fascinating inner space universe. Family of origin can start one off on an easy or difficult life, but can't guarantee it will last. Inherited factors like artistic talent, intelligence, strength, size, imagination, physical beauty, and so on will influence not only one's choice of roles, but how well one performs them. Moreover, as Gray put it in his elegy in a country churchyard, chance plays a major part. We're all born into cultures with dogmatic rules which function as a script or scenario for the play we're acting in. We don't observe social roles, we experience them and respond to them with our own. The extreme woke neurotics respond very badly to our role actions, and without the shared culture and language, our interaction is very limited. Some remote, pre-literate cultures continue for generations without any major perturbations, and the validity of the script is not questioned. Environmental disaster, civil war, economic imperialism, invasion, and charismatic personalities can upset the equilibrium. The script loses its meaning, the narrative becomes absurd, and the actors become distressed. At such times, a new script can appear, and a revitalization process can suddenly take place. Like all evolutionary breakthroughs, these transformations take place at breathtaking speed. Three different missions: love, logic, and levity. Important foundations of our civilization are based on the certainty of the existence and value of their personal souls, of two men in particular, and the devotion of their followers, just as those of the East depend on similar liminal personalities. In opposing the corrupt actions and explanations of the professional priesthood, who, as Jeremiah had pointed out, were rewriting their history and were justifying their power over the people by creating unverifiable texts, which they claim were true and validated by Yahweh. Jesus reporting was saying, among other things, "It is written, but I say unto you." As a unique teacher and healer, he wandered around the countryside, teaching everyone he met who showed interest the way to free themselves from spiritual determinism through love and forgiveness, not only from personal guilt, but from original sin, created and maintained by the Jewish priesthood to gain and maintain power over others. He provided the Western foundations of the doctrine of the equal moral value of all souls, of all human beings, even slaves, women, and children. 500 years earlier, in a similar way, the philosopher Socrates had walked around the city of Athens, conversing with anyone who would talk to him. He did not claim to know or speak the truth. His opinion was that there were two different types of personalities: those wanted to believe and those that wanted to know. As another highly liminal character, an exemplar of his own values, he claimed he was mostly concerned with keeping his own soul free from corruption and avoiding self-deception. He spent much of his time demonstrating that everyone deceived others, and especially themselves, to justify their beliefs and actions. He urged us all to examine our true motives, thereby being a major founder of the latest science of psychology. In a similar but more self-critical and less confident way, I have lived out my own narrative. 50 years ago, I was the first qualified academic sociology lecturer in Australia. I was not a Marxist, but a non-conformist, a rather bohemian lecturer with years of differing experiences outside academia. In the late 1960s, in spite of an excellent teaching record, I was expelled from their formal ranks without any explanation, apparently for the sin of starting the wrong revolution, a fun revolution based on love and logic. Without fully realizing at the time, I was a social scientist traitor to the new neo-Marxist revolutionary narrative. I hope here to try and explain what motivated me, using my knowledge of psychology and sociology, to cautiously destroy my formal identity and reputation to become the first official university-appointed wizard. I began wandering around the city streets in Australia and New Zealand, in provocative attire, often standing on a ladder as an orator and speaking to attract attention. I never claimed the ideas I was expressing were true, being only my opinion or useful fictions, and often exaggerated for dramatic impact. Any purely factual statements I made, I could be checked. Through my playful, symbolic interaction with all and sundry men, women, and young and old, I wanted to demonstrate the power of playful, symbolic interaction, or fun, in freeing both logic and love from being frozen in formal social structures dominated by inauthentic individuals. I will try and explain. Framing the living work of art. As I understand it, the universe is essentially an unpredictable process, not a salvation machine heading towards a sudden, violent conclusion, nor an unstoppable engine accelerating towards a meaningless, materialistic utopia. I cannot fully identify with our rational tradition, given a kickstart by Socrates and Plato, that truth, beauty, and goodness exist as ideals